cents north, 45 degrees east, 651 feet. Cents southeasterly along the meander line, 675 feet to the point of beginning, containing 10 acres, more or less. North of the Lucent cutoff, the water is a red or pink color due to algae in the brine. A string was extended from a central stake in order to get the arcs in the spiral. Is a small blunt peninsula of tertiary rocks extending southward on the north shore of the Great Salt Lake. It is composed of black basalt flows and interbedded irregular lenses of light grayish tan limestone. The basalt is conspicuously vesicular, and the limestone is part bedded and in part massive, with the massive layers fairly porous, much like a spring deposit.
of a sort of 32-minute video film recording the process of the making of Spiral Jetty, but you get a kind of idea that you maybe didn't get it so well during lecture of how significant the process is to the actual meaning behind the piece, and how, you know, you look at it and say, like, how the heck was that made? Well, literally with a bulldozer, right? Scooping up huge loads full of stones, rocks, earth, basalt, salt, and creating the sort of the spiral itself, you know, foot by foot, going back, loading up, going back. And you also saw in the clip Smithson, the artist himself, right, walking out into the water to set up the sort of stakes. So it becomes, if you remember when we were talking about minimalism and the idea of phenomenology, he becomes very physically implicated and present, right, in the making of the work. He connects sort of bodily with the environment as he stakes out the perimeter, the sort of path that the spiral jetty will take. So we see, you know, this is the coolest thing to watch in reverse. I don't know if you have reverse, but it's a cool video to watch in reverse. I don't know what it is about stones going back up into and having backward splash. Isn't it bizarre? Yeah, cool. So we have with Earthworks, as we talked about before, this expanding, you know, definition of art, what it's made of, where it is, the relationship between the viewer. It's certainly far removed from the gallery and the museum space. And it seems to be really about process, about flux, about time. And you can see in this video how he's making reference to not only sort of the idea of now and the process of now while it's being created, but you saw the little cut to dinosaurs. So this also referenced back to prehistoric time, to geologic time, to a much sort of older, slower time. At the same time, this piece is also purposefully trying to play with present and potentially future as it becomes, okay, well, now it becomes less cool backwards. as it becomes implicated in the daily sort of environment and activities of this lake, and of course disappears and ends up sort of being uncreated by the very environment in which it was made. So you can also get an idea from this video and from the slides that we looked at when we saw this piece, as well as the other earthworks that we looked at, how important photography and video are in the recording of these works, how important photographic process is to our being able to get access to these works, right? Because I actually haven't ever taken a trip to Spiral Jetty when it was still around. I don't know if you have, nor have I been to the Lightning Field. And so what makes it possible for us to experience these works is photography and video. So today what we want to do with the time that we have, we want to deal with two things. One thing we want to do is deal with the concept of postmodernism, the P word, aka POMO. Postmodernism, often used to describe visual arts made between the 1960s and the present. And what we're going to do is look specifically at the case of photography. So the implication of photography in postmodern practice. But where we're going to begin is with a little jaunt, a little foray into architecture. So on the left you have, does anyone recognize that building? Any of you New York City folks?
Seagram.
Very good, whoever that was. Seagram Building. This is by Mies van der Rohe. Mies van der Rohe, the Seagram Building, built in the late 1950s. And on the right, any gamblers in the audience?
New York.
Oh, sure, everyone can recognize New York, and Vegas. We got one person who can do Seagram. What does that mean? What does that say? Yes, New York, Las Vegas. Have you been there, Rhonda?
Yes.
Was it fun?
They have a really nice roller coaster.
Just like Manhattan. Yeah, no. so we've got New York on the right, a simulation
of New York City, right, in Las Vegas. A simulation, but not as big, right? It's sort of, do you know how big it is in relationship to the real thing, in terms of scale? Relatively speaking, small, but from a distance, it gives you this idea of the high rise. So New York becomes a kind of icon, symbolized by what? I'm trying not to walk away from the mics. From, with the high rise, can you recognize any of the buildings? Chrysler, I think, Empire State, and of course, on the left-hand side, the Statue of Liberty, located in the middle of water, near Ellis Island, no, in the middle of Las Vegas. Lend me your weary. I was gonna make some joke about, you know, desperate gambling, but I won't, because Las Vegas is about so much more. Albino tigers, magic, the Rat Pack, glamour, and fakeness, right? The idea of a kind of fake substitution for the real thing. So Mies van der Rohe on the left, this is not an example of postmodern architecture, but instead high modernism. Modernism with a capital M, something that we've become increasingly familiar with. And how do we know? How do we characterize it stylistically when we look at it? Is there a lot of ornamentation going on? No, no. So very sort of streamlined, sparse. Actually, if you look at it close up, Mies van der Rohe, the architect who coined the cliche, what's become the cliche, form follows function. Right, it's a very sort of streamlined aesthetic, literally where you can sort of see the construction on the exterior of the building. And in fact, if we had a detailed slide of this building, we would see just this teensiest, tiniest little bit of applied ornament. He's taken steel I-beams and actually placed them on the exterior of the building going vertically. So real vertical emphasis here, right? And those I-beams don't actually serve a support. They, in a sense, mirror the internal skeletal framework of the building, but they, in a sense, become a kind of ornament, if you will, although extremely subtle, extremely refined, extremely spare. So in contrast with this idea of high modernism, something changes in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I'll say from the outset that the term, that P word, postmodernism, is extremely contested amongst scholars and critics, art historians, for example, and other theorists, not agreed upon. You know, don't you wish one time I could come in here and just say, you know, this equals that? Wouldn't that be, what a happy world we'd all live in. But no, here I am again. You know, it's a can of worms, just like that big modernism word was a can of worms, and so is the avant-garde. Some theorists have thought about postmodernism as a kind of radical break from modernism. So a radical shift from the kind of sort of stylistic and theoretical example set by somebody like Mies van der Rohe. Others, however, argue that it's merely a continuation of modernism. Others, still a parody of modernism. But generally speaking, there is a kind of recognition that in the art produced sort of post-60s, in the visual culture produced post-60s, a lot of that work is concerned with articulating a crisis that speaks to sort of questioning the cultural authority of the so-called West, of Western European culture and institutions. So questioning of that kind of authority that we have seen established sort of throughout the 20th century, really. So one critic wrote in the late 70s, quote, the 1970s has not been just another decade. Something did happen. I'm thinking, disco? But wait, that can't be it. Something so momentous that it was ignored in disbelief. Modernity had gone out of style, end quote. So that sort of gives us, does that mean this is a sort of stylistic shift? A story about changing style so that we go from a modernism that values, again, go back to your Greenberg, right? Painting about painting, let's say, the separation of different kinds of art and a very sort of narrow definition of what modernist painting, modernist architecture should be. And it is the shift then to something like the Strip, a kind of amalgamation of, which really in the end becomes an amalgamation, a sort of simulation of something that didn't really exist, a recreated New York City, when in fact that just represents sort of in a very kind of superficial way the idea of the metropolis of Manhattan. So let's look at one artist associated, architect associated with postmodern architecture. This is Robert Venturi, V-E-N-T-U-R-I, Venturi. On the left is his Guild House from Philadelphia, early 1960s. And on the right is a photograph he made with one of his partners of the kindler, gentler Strip of Las Vegas, late 1970s. The Strip, still all about signs. All about signs, and literally through a sign, through a kind of visual icon, in this case textual, instead of the actual shape in terms of, you know, like a New York building, the textual sign of getting your attention, right? Trying to say, like, come here, Stardust, Gold Key Motel, Shopping Center, Loose Slots. I mean, what more do you need to get you to go inside the front doors? So Venturi, along with other architects in the 60s and 70s, instead sort of turns against this very limited vocabulary of high modernist art architecture and embraces the much more pluralistic and, in a sense, pop culture values associated with a place like Las Vegas. And he publishes, along with Denise Scott Brown, a book called Learning from Las Vegas in the 1970s, in which, you know, they talk about embracing these lessons of pop architecture. So no longer minding the split, in a sense, between mass culture, everyday, pop, kitsch, right? This is how we've thought about it in this class. But saying these are all sort of valid vocabularies for architectural practice. It doesn't have to be the all streamlined, form follows function business of Mies van der Rohe, that you can incorporate a whole range of styles and not be limited in that kind of sense. So another example of this is Charles Moore, his Piazza d'Italia in New Orleans. Anyone been here? The late 1970s as well. And again, oftentimes, postmodernism, as it's thought of in terms of a stylistic shift, stylistically it's often characterized as contradictory, as embracing parts from various different styles, historical styles. And so, therefore, it's often thought of as being kind of schizophrenic, right? It doesn't present necessarily one point of view, one doesn't back one sort of, you know, this is my style and I'm going to go with it, I'm going to borrow and take from a whole bunch of different historical times. So it's very eclectic. You get the sense of a pastiche and certainly of what we'll see with photography too, appropriation. And perhaps for us, in terms of a popular culture technique, artistic strategy, the idea of appropriation is most familiar to us through music, I would think, right? How many songs today, and really for the last two decades, are actually samples, right? Samples from other songs that are then put together and then sort of given a maybe slightly different vocal or new beat, right? Sampling, very popular. You're all familiar with that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we'll see the same kind of strategy architecturally. We'll see the same kind of strategy visually with photography. Poor Piazza d'Italia, when I was there in, was like early 90s, like a decade ago, it was full of trash. It was so sad. There were just huge heaps of literal garbage all through it. And yet, oftentimes, it becomes this example of postmodern architecture. I'm pretty sure it's reproduced in the Arneson Prather book, And here we have Charles Moore, who I think you can get the idea is very playfully engaging with a whole range of architectural styles. Right? He's got this sort of Vegas neon along the same lines, well, in the same project. He's got all sorts of different types of columns, making reference to ancient architecture, to Greek architecture, Roman arches, et cetera, and even being so self-reflexive and self-referential that in the corners of these little arches here are little heads, which maybe you can sort of little faces, you can perhaps just begin to make out, and those are actual based on his own face. There you go. So a very sort of self-referential practice too, where you're constantly sort of calling into question your own ability to sort of represent, in this case, yourself, as well as sort of past architectural styles, just globbing them all together. So in addition, I think that we have to think about the idea of postmodernism. Certainly we can see stylistic shifts, but we should also consider how the world had been changing economically and also politically. So that beginning in the 1960s, oftentimes marked as a new economic era, the sort of era of late capitalism, where really we see interpenetration of government and big business to an extent that we hadn't seen before. And I think you can remember back to Lisa's lecture on Wednesday in the work of Hans Hacke, an artist who is explicitly commenting on the interrelationship between government, big business, and the arts. And politically, of course, this is almost within your own memories, although not quite. We have, beginning in the 60s, the increase of a really radical political landscape, right, that sort of starts with student uprisings in Europe and certainly infiltrates university campuses in the United States, particularly this campus, for example. And in 1970, with the bombings of Cambodia and the killings of students at Kent State University, shortly after those, there was the founding, I think that you mentioned this, Lisa, the founding of the New York Art Strike. You didn't mention that? What was the group that Hacke was part of? That other group. So also artists mobilizing with specific political intentions and goals. So for example, with New York Art Strike, made up of a large group of New York artists and writers and also art dealers, some of their actions included sit-ins at the steps of the Metropolitan Museum and also inside the Whitney and the Guggenheim, the mounting of exhibitions for peace, and of course, as the 70s progress, our involvement in Vietnam is stepped up. And other groups also are fighting for political, social, and artistic enfranchisement. And that increases, and so art also takes on a real serious political edge. But first, back to our old favorites. So on the left, we have the artist, Pollock. Do you remember the title? Lavender Mist. Do you remember the date? 1950, right? That's sort of the date that we have for him. And then on the right, the artist, Andy Warhol, and the title? The Maryland Diptych, 62. And the process? Photo silkscreen. So what we have beginning in the 60s, right, with an artist like Warhol that we've seen, or perhaps somebody like Rauschenberg, and we've talked about this before, a real revolt against the version of modernism that critics like Clement Greenberg had been proponents of. So rather than a history of modernism as the logical unfolding toward Jackson Pollock and abstract expressionism, a group of artists who are working in very different ways and continue sort of passed down to other artists in the 70s and 80s, instead wanting to explore the kinds of contradictions and contingencies involved in art making in the social world and the political world at the time. So really, against this kind of depoliticized version of modernist high art, against the idea of high art as being formally pure, against this idea of purity, against the idea of autonomy, and a desire instead to remerge art with life. So artists, and we've seen this, again, we see this with Warhol, taking issue with ideas of originality, with authenticity, with autonomy, by attacking the notion, what's that other A word that we used in relationship to Benjamin in the work of Art and the Age of Mechanical Reproduction? Attacking aura, right? We see that pretty clearly with Warhol. In this sense, and I talked about this a little bit with the Marilyn Monroe and the repetition of her face, both in color and then black and white as it sort of fades out. This idea that there is a kind of unbridgeable distance from the original. There's no way to get back to the original in the Warhol, in a sense, because what are we getting back to but a film still icon of Marilyn Monroe, a kind of self-created, studio-created image of the star. So there's this idea of how do you even, where is the original here? How do you even get back to an original? Is there even a possibility of an original in this work? And without the presence of an original, how can there be aura? How does this complicate, through photographic reproduction, that idea of Benjamin's, of the existence of aura, and how crucial the idea of aura is to understand the kind of value attributed to the gestural abstract expressionism of a painter like Jackson Pollock. So we're seeing this contestation of the uniqueness of the work of art really intensifying in the past three decades, sort of taking off with artists in the 60s and continuing to be questioned through different kinds of pictorial strategies in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. And really, again, what better medium to exploit and explore this idea of aura and authenticity than with the photograph? So on the left here, we have Sherry Levine. After Rodchenko, 1983, Levine. Sherry Levine after Rodchenko, 1983. Sherry Levine, an artist, and this is an example of her work, an artist who becomes relatively prominent in the 1980s, and she works for the most part with the pirated print. She's stealing photographs, basically, that have already been made by relatively usually canonical artists. Alexander Rodchenko, someone you're familiar with, for example, or people from, artists from the canon of modern photography, Edward Weston would be another example, or Walker Evans, who you saw briefly when we talked about FSA photographs. After Rodchenko. So she actually takes the print and displays it as her own work. She takes them in different ways. Sometimes she rephotographs, sometimes she takes posters. According to Douglas Crimp, who writes about postmodern photography, quote, a group of young artists, and he's referring to Levine, working with photography, have addressed photography's claims to originality, showing those claims for the fiction they are, showing photography to be always a representation, always already seen. Their images are purloined, confiscated, appropriated, stolen. In their work, the original cannot be located. So again, we see an artist here, Levine, deconstructing the modernist notion of the original. And you should think about this and this as being part of a lineage of art production in the 20th century, a lineage starting really with what artist? The big D, right? Right, with Duchamp. So again, we shouldn't, and this can influence how you yourself want to think about postmodernism and how you define it. But here we're picking up, of course, practices from much earlier in the 20th century. But you also want to think about how they're different, right? How these kinds, how pirating a photograph, let's say, and showing it sort of as your work, how that kind of gesture is different, what are the different kinds of implications between that and, say, taking a urinal and displaying it under the name R. Mutt. So appropriation here we can see as being a very key strategy in postmodern photography. And here again, she's questioning, as Warhol is, the idea of autonomy. She's refusing authorship, and in that sense, dismantling that notion of the unique, original work of art with aura. Right? How does this have aura anymore? And then what does it mean for it not to? How does this become part of a gallery system, for example? How does this become part of the commodity system, part of the art market? So appropriation as a very key strategy in postmodern photographic practice. Two other artists we have here on the right is Richter, R-I-C-H-T-E-R, a photo painting called Betty. It's a painting based on a photograph. And on the right, Boltanski, I'm just giving you last names, B-O-L-T-A-N-S-K-I. And again, these are taken straight from your final exam slide list. This is The Drawer from 1988. So it's an installation, right, multimedia. He's using a photograph, a light, and, of course, a drawer. According to Richter, I pursue no objectives, no system, no tendency. I have no program, no style, no direction. Seems like a bit of a nihilist, no? I have no time for specialized concerns, working themes, or variations that lead to mastery. Again, mastery is a kind of notion tied up with high modernism, right? With Pollock, right? There can be this idea of this, on the one hand, this sort of master creator, this master genius, and then with Greenberg, in terms of a critical point of view, a master reading, like one way to read this kind of work. Back to Richter, I steer clear of definitions. I don't know what I want. Oh, isn't that so true for most of us? I am inconsistent, non-committal, passive. I like the indefinite, the boundless. I like continual uncertainty. So certainly voicing a lot of the kinds of concerns and a sense of some artists associated with postmodernism, right? Instead of being the sort of heroic, modernist artist, here is a trace of my genius, taking a much different approach philosophically towards his own artistic production. I steer clear of definitions. I don't even know what I want. I'm inconsistent. You know, I take from a lot of different sources. I create a lot of different kinds of work. And in fact, he's an artist that ranges from a kind of photorealism in this painting based on a photograph to complete sort of abstract paintings. This portrait in particular on the left is made of his teenage daughter, Betty. Again, based on a photograph. And we can make comparisons between this work and the Boltanski on the right and how they're using the photograph in a sense, on the one hand, to recall how oftentimes we think of the photograph, particularly the photograph of a person functioning, right, to record individual characteristics, to give us a document of that person, a kind of map of that person's individual face and the features that describe that individual person. But they're subverting that, right, that practice. Richter is because her head's turned, so we don't get her face. We get the back of her head instead. And furthermore, he's blurred the edges slightly. So the painting has this strange quality of being on the one hand sort of based in a kind of photorealism. On the other hand, we are denied access to her face, and we're also given the really sort of blurred edge, so that you get the question of you can't really necessarily define with any specificity the subject through image making, through photography, nor through the painting based on the photograph. Boltanski, and what I'll do is I'll forward to another one of his works on the left. This is another work by Boltanski called Monuments, also referred to as the Children of Dijon, made from the mid-80s. Boltanski often, in his multimedia installations, uses anonymous photographs and places them in a really kind of poignant way with light directed onto their surfaces. But with the example of Drawer on the right, we get this idea again of this portrait, right? This close-up of a face that maybe reminds you of, I don't know, a high school yearbook photograph, maybe a yearbook, college yearbook photograph. On the other hand, it's so blurred that the actual identity of the person is obscured. So again, he's playing around with this idea of photographic truthfulness. And that it's furthermore obscured, at the same time, it's highlighted by the placement of this light fixture, which on the one hand literally like bars your vision, right? You can't see the center of the image because it's being blocked by this light. At the same time, it's actually illuminating the rest of the image. So this constant sort of tension between revealing, using the photograph to sort of reveal the specificity of identity, at the same time sort of denying you access to that actual individual. So it becomes this just sort of implied presence instead. Also in the monuments on the left, as you can see, very small individual portraits, some smiling, some sort of more passive, and strewn in between them, these lights. And some of his work, including the monuments on the left, is making reference to pre-war Jewish children, school photographs that had been taken of children who, of course, never returned to their schools after the Second World War. So you get this, again, this idea of photography on the one hand of evoking a kind of anonymity, but one that speaks potentially for, you know, millions of specific lives extinguished, lost, extinguished, but as he's sort of recalling them through the individual sort of lights placed around the photographs. So they become, and you can see this is sort of in a kind of church setting, ironically, they become really evocative of, again, lost presence. I'm going to show you one other artist. Two other artists. On the left is Patrick Nagatani. N-A-G-A-T-A-N-I. Nagatani, and this is his National Atomic Museum, Kirtland Air Force Base, 1989 color photograph. On the right, an image by Jeff Wall, W-A-L-L, called Stumbling Block from 1991. Color transparency, light, and display case. Now, we've seen artists who are using the appropriated image, right? Who are taking already made images and incorporating them into their work. Here are two examples of artists who instead create a very self-consciously composed, manipulated, and fictionalized image. So use photography as a kind of basis to create a whole tableau, a kind of almost stage set. And again, this too calls into question the truthfulness of the photographic image, the kind of fiction that photographs often construct. So they're using the apparent truthfulness of photography sort of against itself. An artist like Jeff Wall is going to create these tableaus, these sort of scenes of drama, this sort of slice of narrative, blow them up, alter them computerly with a computer, blow them up, backlight them. They're transparencies that are then backlit. And according to Wall, they exist in quote-unquote the gray area between the theatrical and the real. So that's the image on the right. Nagatani on the left, he uses photographs, generally speaking, as backdrops in a sense. So this Kirtland Air Force Base is a black and white photograph that he's taken. Then he goes back to his studio. He blows the image up. Usually it's a sort of over-life size, puts it in the back of his studio, and then starts to layer other images and painting over that original photograph. So here he's obviously painted a lot of the backdrop red. He's taken photographs, these are actually family members, although that's not necessarily relevant, made photographs of them, enlarged them, made them into sort of cardboard cutouts, cut them out, and then hung them in the space of his studio. So you maybe can start to make out, can you see these thin lines going down? These are holding up the sort of cardboard cutouts of his family that have been, you know, costumed, dressed in kimonos, eating sushi. And then he himself, sort of at the last second, this is the artist, Nagatani, inserts himself physically into the image. And then the work of art is a photograph then taken of the entire tableau. So it becomes reinterpreted. It sort of starts with a photograph, and it ends with a photograph. But in between, there are multiple layers of different kinds of artistic gesture, including painting, other photography. He'll build models and hang them from the top of the studio. And as you can see here, this is part of a larger body of work called Nuclear Enchantment, in which he's dealing with, in particular, the nuclear history of the state of New Mexico, where he lives. And I think maybe you can make out in the reflection, this is actually his mother, Diane, the reflection of her sunglasses. Aaron, who's in the front? Can you see what's in the reflection of her sunglasses? You see in the front? A mushroom cloud. Right, so the idea is she's looking off to the distance and seeing the effects of an explosion of a nuclear bomb. So again, this idea of using photography as a piece, in a sense, to create this kind of fictional tableau. I want to show you one other work by Nagatani. This is called Japanese American Concentration Camps, Manzanar, 1994, a color photograph. And so this is late 80s. This is sort of mid-90s on the right-hand side. So in this work on the left with his Nuclear Enchantment series, he's working very much in the kind of vocabulary that is often associated with postmodernism. This idea of, on the one hand, appropriation, but the different layering of different kinds of artistic gesture and technique, building models and creating this whole sort of fictionalized tableau. But on the right-hand side in this work, he instead is using unmanipulated color landscape images. And this becomes part of another series, another portfolio called Japanese American Concentration Camps. And just briefly to mention the sort of background behind this piece, his parents, who you see here and there, during World War II had been incarcerated in internment camps. His father in Arkansas and his mother in Manzanar in California. And along with basically the rest of the population of Japanese descent along the west coast of the United States. This is after the bombing of Pearl Harbor. And Nagatani grew up not knowing or hearing very much about this experience of incarceration. He was born just after the war, decided in the 90s to go back to these sites and photograph the remains of these camps, decided to make a kind of connection to this experience of not only his parents, but of Japanese Americans in this country, a really sort of incredibly important experience. And so he goes back to the sites, and you can see in the image on the right, Manzanar is located in Southern California. Maybe some of you have been there. You can go visit it now. It's about 250 miles northeast of Los Angeles. And in the background, you can see really dramatic mountains. In the foreground, these stone steps. And if you go there, you see a lot of sort of ruins of remains of the incarcerated population who was held there in the 1940s, including his mother. So these idea, these ruined steps that lead really to nowhere, right? So you get this kind of eerie idea of this past crime, sort of past purpose that this land was put to. And again, it's a very stylistically very different practice than what's going on in his earlier work on the left, but I don't think we need to think about postmodernism again. The trap is to think about it purely in sort of stylistic terms. And instead, I think we need to open it up and think a little bit about more in terms of meaning and in terms of content, in terms of purpose. So with the image on the right and with that body of work, he seems to be trying to come to terms with this certain traumatic event of the past. As, in a sense, he's doing with the nuclear history of New Mexico, as Boltanski is doing in the work that we saw just a couple slides before. And at the same time, he's also, Nagatani on the right in particular, is focusing, although it seems maybe not so overtly because he's using landscape, but really focusing on the politics of identity, right, of looking back into his past and into the past of all Japanese Americans in this country, and this kind of shared traumatic experience that they endured during the Second World War. I'm sure you all know her. I'm sure you all know her well. Here we have Cindy Sherman. Cindy Sherman, one of the most well-known artists who really comes to prominence in the 1980s. These are two of her untitled film stills from the late 70s. Two untitled film stills from the late 70s. And we see here, and as we'll continue next week, we'll look a little bit at Sherman, at other women artists in the 80s, Barbara Kruger, Lorna Simpson, and the Guerrilla Girls, and we'll think about how these strategies of photographic appropriation and the construction of the tableau, the sort of fictionalized photograph, how these artists in particular are using these strategies to, on the one hand, again, comment on the politics of identity, but also do so particularly on the role and the representation of women. So have an excellent weekend, and I'll see you on Monday.